and welcome to Animal Voices here on CIUT 89.5 FM. My name is Catherine Brigantino. I will be your host for today. I'm joined by Steve Romanen, who's teching the show. Big thank you to Steve for making the technology work. We will be talking to Joyce Tischler, the co-founder of the Animal Legal Defense Fund. So really looking forward to that interview. But first, we will turn to Kevin Tillman of the Vegan Hip Hop Movement for his regular segment.
Greetings, Animal Voices. It's Kevin from the Vegan Hip Hop Movement. Peter Young, nationally renowned animal rights organizer and advocate for social justice, says, "Jared Paul is a firestorm of conviction and flow. In a world long on words and short on action, Jared delivers both." From Jared's Fight the Tide album, here is "It's All Right, Mom, I'm Only Bleeding."
Hey, this is Carl, and you're listening to college radio in whatever redneck state you live in that ain't Jersey. But I got news for you. The Garden State rules your ass, and you ain't gonna be able to do anything about it. So, suck on it.
This is a special dedication to my dad and my sister. Get one hand free, because it's time for the Bob Dylan cover. Now, I don't think I've read a poem off page on stage since, like, 1997, so bear with me. I'm gonna try to channel Bernard for a second, because Bernard does this better than anybody I've seen. Stacey thinks something's funny over there. What's up, Stacey?
Hello.
How many people like Bob Dylan? Yeah! This is called "It's All Right, Mom, I'm Only Bleeding." As some warn victory, some downfall, private reasons, great or small, can be seen in the eyes of those that call to make all that should be killed to crawl, while others say don't hate nothing at all except hatred. Can I get an amen?
Amen!
We're having a reading from the Reverend Bob Dylan, the Reverend Robert Zimmerman right now. Disillusioned words like bullets bark as human gods aim for their mark, making everything from toy guns that spark to flesh-colored Christ that glow in the dark. It's easy to see without looking too far that not much is really sacred. Can I get a go vegan?
Go vegan!
I said, can I get a go vegan?
Go vegan!
While preachers preach of evil fates, teachers teach that knowledge waits can lead to $100 plates and goodness hides behind its gates. But even the president of these United States must sometimes have to stand naked. And although the rules of the road have been lodged, it's only other people's games you got to dodge. And it's all right, Ma, because I can make it. Advertising times, they con you into thinking that you're the one that can do what's never been done, that can win what's never been won. In the meantime, life outside goes on all around you. A question in your nerves is lit, yet you know there's no answer fit to satisfy and assure you not to quit, and to keep your mind and not forget that it is not he or she or them or it that you belong to. But though the masters make the rules for the wise men and the fools, I got nothing, Ma, to live up to. For them that must obey authority that they do not respect in any degree, who despise their jobs, their destiny, speak jealously of those that are free, do what they do just to be nothing more than something they invest in. While some on principles baptize too strict party platform ties, they're really just social clubs in drag disguise. Outsiders they can freely criticize and tell nothing except who to idolize and then say, God bless him.
Get it, Jared.
One sings with his tongue on fire, gargles in the rat race choir, bent out of shape from society's pliers, cares not to come up any higher, but rather just to get you down in the hole that he's in. But I mean no harm, nor put fault on anyone that lives in a vault, but it's all right, Ma, if I can't please him. Old lady judges watch people in pairs, limited in sex they dare, to push fake morals, insult and stare. While money doesn't talk, it swears. I said, while money don't talk, it swears. Obscenity, who really cares? Propaganda, all is phony. While them that defend what they cannot see with the killer's pride, security, it blows their minds most bitterly. For them that think that death's honesty won't fall upon them naturally, life sometimes must have to get lonely. My eyes collide head on with stuffed graveyards, false goals. I scoff at pettiness, which plays rough walk upside down inside handcuffs and kick my legs to cracks and say I've had enough. Now what else can you show me? And if my thought dreams could be seen, then they'd probably put my head in a guillotine. But it's all right, Ma. It's life, and life only.
Hello and welcome back to Animal Voices here on CIUT 89.5 FM. We are pleased to be joined by Joyce Tischler today. A very exciting interview for us. Joyce Tischler is the co-founder of the Animal Legal Defense Fund, which was the first national nonprofit legal organization to focus on protecting the lives of animals. Joyce Tischler has served as the executive director for the Animal Legal Defense Fund for 25 years and now serves as the organization's general counsel. Widely regarded as a pioneer in the field of animal law, Joyce has dedicated her life to advancing anti-cruelty legislation, encouraging enforcement of animal protection laws, and taking steps to bring the field of animal law into the mainstream. Welcome to the show, Joyce Tischler.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm wondering if we can just start off by talking about why did you go into law school and, you know, how did you end up working to protect animals?
It wasn't a straight line because there were no jobs, as far as I knew, working for animals as a lawyer at that time. This is going back to 1974, which was before Peter Singer's book came out. But I've always said animal people come in two flavors. They're the ones who have an epiphany of some sort. They read something or they see something and they say, aha, I need to protect animals. Or the ones who are born into it, and I'm in the latter class. I just, as far back as I could remember, I cared about animals. I had a special feeling for animals. When I was a little kid and was allowed to walk around the block, I was bringing home cats I thought were lost. I was probably stealing people's cats, not knowing that. I was bringing home injured birds. I just was always doing it. When I was in college, within a few weeks of arriving at college, I noticed that there were some little houses near the library, and there were cats coming in and out of those houses, and I quickly became part of the campus cat movement. We cared for, spayed, and neutered, and got medical attention for about 100 cats a year, and we placed them. And so when I went to law school, and this is coming out of the 60s and the turbulent 60s in the U.S., and I had worked against the Vietnam War, and I thought lawyers were change agents, so I wanted to go to law school to do good things for society. And the animal issue just, it was always there on the periphery. When I wrote a law review article, it was after Singer's book had come out, and that book, for many people, and I'm one of them, gave us something to hang our hats on. I wasn't just an animal lover anymore. I was someone who had a philosophy and who believed in animal rights. And so I wrote a law review article about animal legal rights, extending legal rights to animals. And I spent quite a while on that article. And when I left law school, I tried to get a job in environmental law. Again, there were no jobs in animal law. And with environmental law, while I'm an environmentalist, it's not where my passion is. I thought, well, if I'm working to protect forests, there are animals in that forest who will benefit from their habitat being protected. That was as close as I thought I could get. But I moved to the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, and got a job not in environmental law, just in regular old-fashioned law. And in the evenings and weekends, I was doing volunteer work for the Fund for Animals. And through that office, I met Larry Kesnick, the co-founder of Animal Legal Defense Fund. We thought, well, if there are two of us who believe in animal rights, perhaps there are more. And we put out an ad in our local legal newspaper, said we were having a meeting, and six more people showed up. We thought, okay, great. So we started meeting once a month and teaching ourselves about the plight of animals, the problems that animals face, the various laws, both California and federal, that relate to animals. And once a month, someone would make a report, and, you know, there were no animal law classes, there were no case books, there were no conferences, really, and so we had to teach ourselves. And that's how it started, with just, you know, with this little group in San Francisco, and then we started to network. We found out that there was someone in Los Angeles who was taking cases to protect animals, a woman named Marcelle Philpott Bryant. And I got back in touch with someone I knew in college. She was still in New York, where I had come from. And she had started a group of lawyers. Her name was Jolene Marion. And there was another attorney in New York, Henry Mark Holzer, who was the one who networked all of us. He had two things that he used. One was a publication called the Animal Rights Law Reporter, which was published for about 4 years. And it had news about cases and news about legislation and a bulletin board. So he introduced our little group to others in the country who were thinking about this or putting time into animal protection, animal rights. And then in 1981, he put together a conference, and it was the first time that identifiable animal rights lawyers were all in the same room. There were about 60 people in that room. Some were activists, about half were activists, the other half were lawyers and law students, and that was a turning point. That was when I met Stephen Wise, who has gone on to do some absolutely brilliant writing, both in law review articles and in books such as Rattling the Cage. We met there David Faber, who is a professor at Michigan State and who has also done some of the most creative thinking about how one could create rights for animals out of whole cloth. And out of that conference, Larry and I formed our national board, and I say that with a smile on my face because there were so few of us that, and we were spread all over the country, but we were national at this point coming from this little group in San Francisco and another little group in New York. And so as we started to meet each other and to dream together and to work together, that's when a lot of the ideas for cases came together.
The founding of the Animal Legal Defense Fund certainly has an interesting story then. It sounds like, I mean, there really wasn't anything such as animal law or an animal law movement that was really crystallized yet. And here you are all coming together from across the country trying to protect animals' interests. But I mean, just to be clear, what are we talking about when we're talking about animal rights law, you know, as a legal discipline?
Well, big question.
Big question, sorry.
Well, we talk about the law. And of course, the law is very different in the United States than it is in Canada. We've had several Canadian law clerks, and there really is a difference between our legal systems, how they work. In the U.S., the legal system is an inherently conservative, and by conservative I mean maintaining the status quo system. It's about property and protecting the property of human beings. Mm. And so when we talk about animals, we are talking about beings whom the law doesn't recognize as sentient beings. It recognizes them as the property of human beings. Mm. And so when we're suggesting to a judge that a piece of property could have interests or rights, which is even more radical of a concept, that judge is being asked to grapple with something that's really not been discussed before in his or her courtroom. And we have learned that we need to not push the judge too far. We need to make it as familiar as possible. And so most of what we do, quite frankly, is not animal rights. It's animal protection. Mm. We're trying to use existing laws, such as state anti-cruelty laws, if we can, and I'll get back to that, or the National Environmental Policy Act, which is an environmental law, or the Endangered Species Act, which is another federal law that just protects endangered species, or other laws. I mean, what we're constantly looking for is, can we take a law that's on the books now and interpret it in a novel way so that animals get greater protections than they currently have? Mm-hmm. Currently, animals really don't have a whole lot of protection except under state anti-cruelty laws. And those laws in every state in the U.S., there are 50 of them, specify what constitutes cruelty. Failure to provide food or water or shelter or veterinary care, and it varies from state to state. The major problem we face with these cruelty laws is that we have no ability in most places to enforce them. That's the job of state officials or county officials. They're called prosecutors. And if the prosecutor chooses not to enforce the law, It's completely within his or her discretion, and there's nothing we can do to override that discretion. And so most of what happens to animals in the context of cruelty in the U.S. really doesn't get addressed. It first of all has to be investigated, and then the investigator has to bring it to a prosecutor, and the prosecutor has to choose to prosecute. If it gets to that point, then we can assist the prosecutor, and we do. We have a whole program of assisting prosecutors. We will find expert witnesses. We will pay to get them to the courthouse. We will do legal research in the background, whatever we can do to help the prosecution. And by doing that, we have improved the quality of prosecutions and the number of wins, of victories, where people who are committing cruelty have been convicted of cruelty. But that's usually the individual who does something. The far greater problem in our country and in yours is institutionalized animal abuse. And by that I mean the large numbers, in the case of animals raised for food, the billions of animals who are raised for food. Mm. And in this country, and in most others, big agriculture has really tightly controlled the setting of standards in the law, so that in most states in the U.S., farmed animals are specifically excluded from the reach of the anti-cruelty laws. So anything that's done to them is per se not cruel. It can't be prosecuted. How do you protect animals who the law simply ignores? That's a huge problem. It's one that we have grappled with for many years, with growing success in the last few years, not through cases, not through lawsuits, but through legislative efforts and what's called initiatives and referenda in the U.S. So back to what we can do, we can take a look at a given law and then do a great deal of research. I mean, it takes us 6 months to a year to do research on any given piece of litigation that we're going to do. Sometimes less, but a lot of times what we're doing is being highly creative within a system that doesn't value our creativity. And so we're trying to figure out how to put square pegs into round holes a lot of the time. Let me be specific. Many years ago, one of our board members, who is a guy named Peter Lovenheim, in his non-work hours, he liked to invest. And he had invested in a company called Iroquois Brands because he saw, and this was the early 1980s, he saw that they put out food supplements and and other things that he thought were good, were environmentally safe and were good. But then when he got one of their reports, he saw that they were also marketing goose liver pate. Mm. And he knew from the work he did that goose liver pate, as well as duck liver pate, it's called foie gras, is produced by very painfully force-feeding geese, so that their livers enlarge over the course of a month to many times the size that they would be normally. And he also remembered sitting in law school and reading a case in which the shareholders of Dow Chemical were asking the company to stop selling napalm, which is a horrible, horrible product, which was being used on people in Vietnam. It was being dropped on them. And so the shareholders brought a resolution asking the company not to sell napalm unless they could be assured that it was not going to be used against human beings. And that earlier case had gone to the U.S. Court of Appeals, and the court upheld the plaintiff's, the shareholder's right to bring this resolution because it was an important moral issue. So Peter Lovenheim thought, hey, let's do the same thing with animals. And it had never been done before. Mm-hmm. So he sent a letter to the president of Iroquois Brands and said, we have an important issue here. You're carrying a product that involves force-feeding geese. It's very cruel to the animals, and I would like to ask you to form a committee to study the issue. He received a very polite response, basically telling him that they were not at all interested in his shareholder proposal. So he tried it a couple more times, and in his proposal he described the force-feeding process in great detail, how horribly cruel it is and what it does to these animals and how sick it makes them. And the company completely ignored him. So eventually, he filed suit. And he asked for a declaratory and injunctive relief in a federal court, U.S. District Court. and he asked the court to stop Iroquois Brands from excluding his proposal from their materials at their shareholders' meetings. And he won the case, which was really wonderful. And the court said, yes, there is ethical and social significance to this proposal, and that Iroquois Brands should carry it. And following this victory, which is really significant, Peter went to the shareholder meeting and presented his proposal. And it was roundly defeated, which may seem like a defeat, but you know what? The point had been made. And the case is still on the books from the district court. And it had been covered by a lot of the mainstream press, including the Wall Street Journal, the Associated Press, the Washington Post. And when the media was talking about the case, they were describing in great detail the force-feeding method, so that Americans were reading, many of them for the first time, about this horrible, cruel method. And it could have been taken as a fringe issue if that were the only issue, but in the context of corporations, you know, corporate law and a shareholder proposal, it was taken very seriously. And Peter Loewenheim realized that he had created a legal tool that could be used on a broader basis. And he brought the idea to two of the major movers in the animal rights movement, Henry Spira, who was one of the most creative and brilliant of tacticians in the animal rights movement, who then used this technique in negotiating with some of the fast food companies. And Peter also brought the idea to Ingrid Newkirk of PETA, and he worked with PETA to file shareholder proposals with dozens of pharmaceutical and cosmetic companies.
It is a campaign that PETA still actively conducts today. They have members who come to them who own stock in pharmaceutical or cosmetic companies or other companies, and they work with those members to develop shareholder proposals to bring to the companies asking for more humane practices. So it's an interesting example, something one might never have thought of, using shareholder proposals to protect animals, but it's one that has been used a lot. There are other things that lawyers have done. In the early days, a lot of the cases that we brought were highly experimental. For example, one of the earliest animal rights lawyers was a woman named Marcel Philpott Bryant. And she used the National Environmental Policy Act. And that's a federal law which, in a nutshell, says that before the federal government does some major program or anything, in fact, it has to prepare a set of documents called an environmental impact statement. And in that, it has to take a look at how its action is going to impact the environment. So what Marcel did was to use that to protect animals. And that's not what NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, was actually designed to do, but that's how she used it. She was contacted by the Fund for Animals, and she was told that the U.S. Navy, one of our military arms, was going to shoot about 4,000 feral wild goats on a tiny island off the coast of Southern California. And so she filed a lawsuit claiming that the Navy had failed to prepare an environmental impact statement and that the shooting of these 4,000 goats was going to impact the environment. Mm-hmm. And the court agreed with her and granted a temporary restraining order to defeat the government's plan to shoot these feral burros. So the interesting thing was that here she was using this federal law in a way that environmentalists had not envisioned. Mm. She was trying to protect animals. They were not endangered animals. They weren't even native to this little island, but she was able to protect them using this federal law. And that was the kind of case that we started taking, trying to figure out how to use laws in a way that had not been used before. Now, a far more recent example of that is that we heard about a law, we Animal Legal Defense Fund heard about a law in the state of North Carolina. And I said earlier that when cruelty occurs, for the most part, we're left with our pants down. There's nothing much we can do if the prosecutor chooses not to prosecute. But we found out that North Carolina has this interesting little law that hadn't been used much. And this law enabled us to civilly sue. And that means there are two different systems in this country, civil and criminal. Mm. And we could go into civil court and sue to enjoin or stop cruelty. We found out about a couple in a little town in North Carolina, Sanford, North Carolina. They had 500 dogs. And it was basically a factory farm for dogs. And the dogs were being kept in horrible, horrible conditions. The very worst conditions were in their garage, where they had 170 dogs being kept in the kinds of crates that you take your cat to the veterinarian in, these plastic crates. And these dogs were small dogs. They never got out of those crates. And they were piled 4 and 5 high. And if you could just imagine living in those crates, living in their own excrement, never getting out of there. It gets extremely hot in North Carolina in the summertime. And these dogs were in an enclosed garage. And a lot of them died in those crates. None of the dogs were given veterinary care. There were dogs with broken bones, fractured jaws, untreated cancers. And it was just a hellhole for these dogs. And local activists knew about it. They wanted to do something about it. But the local animal control had about 5 kennels. And so what were you going to do with 500 dogs? Mm. The local prosecutor had tried to prosecute for cruelty and had failed. So they weren't going to go back and do it. So we did our research and we put together a case and we filed a lawsuit. And this was about, December of 2004. And we brought it to the judge and we were asking the judge to stop the cruelty, to enjoin it, to issue a preliminary injunction. That's the legal term. And the judge actually left the bench, went out to the farm where the dogs were, took a look around, went back to the bench and issued a preliminary injunction saying that, yes, this was cruel and it needed to be stopped. But that wasn't the end of the case. That was actually just the beginning. Using our evidence, the prosecutor prosecuted for the 12 worst cases of abuse they could find. And then the two cases moved forward to trial, which didn't come until the end of March of 2005. In the interim, our veterinarian was going to the Woodley farm every day to treat the animals and to try to make their lives measurably better. We weren't allowed to remove animals unless they were in dire straits, and so we were able to remove about 100 of the animals, of the dogs who were in the worst condition and could die before it got to trial. Also, I forgot to mention this, before we brought our suit, Mrs. Woodley knew we were going to sue because it was hard to hide the fact that we were investigating. And so she had some friends of hers clean out the garage. And so the dogs who were in the worst condition, the 170 dogs in those crates, were taken out of there before our lawsuit had started. So we were dealing with about 330, give or take, because a lot of the females were pregnant. We went to trial in March of 2005, and we won at trial, which was an incredible victory for us. We didn't know if this judge in this small area in North Carolina was going to see it the way we saw it. We thought it was clearly cruelty, but we weren't sure that we could prove that. The judge agreed with us, and about 10 days later when the order was signed, we went to the Woodley farm, and within a period of 8 hours, we removed every dog from there. And here's where it got to be not so much legal, but, okay, now what do you do with 330 sick, unsocialized dogs, most of whom are scared of human beings? They're covered in their own excrement. They're covered in urine. They need to be cleaned. They need to be fed. They need to be socialized. And that's when the real serendipity happened. The people in that area came together and helped us. Someone donated the use of a building that had been abandoned for 20 years. Someone donated linoleum. All we had was dirt floors and we needed to keep the dogs well. The linoleum enabled us to clean the floors every hour and clean up after the dogs. And people came and fed them and sat with them and socialized them, and we just started getting them into foster homes as quickly as we could. And Mrs. Woodley fought us. She wanted to get her dogs back. She fought us all the way up to the highest court in the state of North Carolina. And so the legal work still needed to be done. And at the end of the road, we won all the way up. The court said we had standing. The court said this law could be applied. So we've been able to go back several times after that to get other animals in North Carolina out of harm's way. And now what we're trying to do is introduce this law in other states in the U.S. so that we can give activists a legal tool that enables them to do what we did in North Carolina with the Woodley case. And all of the dogs in the Woodley case did get into homes. We did not have to euthanize any dogs except for a few who were so sick and so far gone that we couldn't save them.
What a nice story of success where you're directly tackling, you know, a form of animal exploitation and abuse. This is not unusual to the Animal Legal Defense Fund. Certainly you all have worked on, you know, many issues, confinement of veal calves, you know, leg hold trap, hot face branding of dairy cows, all these, you know, really prominent cases. I'm wondering, though, like, who actually, tell us more about this, the issue of legal standing to sue, you know, when an animal is harmed. Who has legal standing to sue? Can we advocate on behalf of animals for their pain and suffering, or how does this work?
Well, oftentimes it doesn't work very well. Legal standing is an issue that has plagued us from the very start and will continue to. Let me give you an analogy. In the field of environmental law in the United States, environmental law came into its own in the 1970s, and a number of laws were passed by Congress and signed into law, and they created legal standing for environmental organizations. They had something called the citizen suit provision, which basically said citizens could sue to protect the environment. It needed to be fleshed out through litigation, and it was. And a legal fiction was developed which said, and I'm simplifying this, if I go to a pristine wilderness area and I take photographs and I hike, I have an aesthetic interest in preserving that place the way it is. And if I'm going to continue to go back, I want to see it as it is. And so that's how environmentalists often gain standing to protect various areas in the country. Animal laws, number one, there are very few, and the ones that exist do not have those citizen suit provisions. And so we are often turning ourselves into pretzels trying to figure out ways to argue to courts in a way that they will hear us and agree with us that we have standing on behalf of animals to protect them. If I am concerned about the intensive confinement of a veal calf and the suffering of a veal calf, I'm dealing with an animal or a group of animals who are the property of the farmer who is putting them into those conditions. Clearly, the farmer's not going to sue to change the conditions. And the court's going to ask me, well, what standing do you have? What interest do you have? Are you harmed financially? And the answer is no, I'm not harmed financially. Is your health harmed? Well, no, my emotional well-being is harmed. And the court's going to say, well, I'm sorry, but the law doesn't protect your emotional well-being. I'm sorry you're upset, but that's not going to work. So with each case that we take, we have to find ways to convince the court that somehow the people bringing the case, the plaintiffs, have indeed been harmed. And that's really hard to do. In the case that I mentioned earlier of the shareholder could say, I have an interest here. I have invested in your corporation, and so I am being harmed financially because my money is being used to harm animals. You're selling a product that is cruel. But we had a series of cases. We spent close to 20 years trying to enforce the Federal Animal Welfare Act, which is a law that provides minimum protections, absolutely bare bones minimum protections, for animals used in research laboratories. And we were kicked out of court repeatedly. We finally were able to find a way to convince the court that we had an interest. And it wasn't in laboratories. It was with a plaintiff who would go to roadside zoos and see primates, see chimpanzees who were in isolation and who were suffering. And so we argued basic, and I apologize if this is getting complex now, we argued the kind of standing that environmentalists argue. This plaintiff could say, I have an aesthetic interest in going to this roadside zoo and seeing this chimpanzee in a healthy environment and having things to do in his cage, and having the companionship of others of his own kind. And because he doesn't have that, I am harmed. It's a strange legal fiction, but yeah, that is what ultimately enabled us to try to enforce the Federal Animal Welfare Act.
So, I mean, it's not really about the interests of that chimpanzee, for example, at all.
No, it's not. It's not.
I mean, there's no room in the law to talk about their interests as having any sort of, you know, meaning. So there's definitely this sense of immediacy. I mean, we want to get the chimpanzees out of laboratories. We want to get the cows off the slaughter line. And certainly, you know, litigation is a more immediate action that can produce sort of action today and maybe tomorrow. Whereas it seems like legislative change takes a lot of time. Can you tell us more about the different approaches?
Right. As you can see from what I've just said, litigation has its limits.
Yeah.
If you can't get standing on behalf of an animal to represent the animal's interest, you really are stuck.
Yeah.
And with regard to farmed animals, we realized that we were so limited that litigation was going to have only a minor impact on the stranglehold of the conditions of animals on factory farms. And interestingly, and let me just step back for a moment and say, in my mind, there's not one tool that's going to move us forward. Okay. I see a combination of three major tools, maybe four. One is litigation. Another is legislation, bringing about new laws. Third is education. If we don't educate the public, if we don't create a groundswell of support for what we're doing, judges are people, and if they can't understand what we're trying to do and buy into it, they're not going to go along with what we're trying to do. People like to think that judges merely apply law. They bring a set of biases and political and religious and all sorts of other beliefs with them onto the bench. And that colors the way that they determine who's going to win or who's going to lose a lawsuit. So it's legislation, litigation, education. And then I think also in our country, getting out into the street, the Occupy Wall Street movement that is growing by leaps and bounds, there's a reason for that. There are a lot of people angry about what has happened financially in the United States and how the middle class has been left out. And so that's why you're seeing all that demonstration going on. So here's another example of where a lawyer began to really affect something happening in the U.S. For many years, there were just a few groups, a few very small groups working on farmed animal issues in the U.S., unlike what was happening in Europe with the EU and in England. The U.S., when I came into the movement, the U.S. was very much focused on the use of animals in research and fur farming and hunting and trapping. I came in 1979, and those were the big issues then. No one was really focused on farmed animals. And a lawyer named David Wolfson, who was educated in the U.S. and practices in New York in a large firm. David had actually grown up in England, where factory farming was being addressed in a big way, and he felt it was the single most important animal protection issue. When he moved to the U.S., he was surprised that we weren't focused on this. And when he was in law school, he started to research the anti-cruelty laws, and he noticed that farmed animals were exempted from the protections of most anti-cruelty laws. And he thought that was rather strange. So he eventually wrote a paper pointing this out, and that paper was published in many forms, but as a law review article called Beyond the Law, Agribusiness and the Systemic Abuse of Animals Raised for Food or Food Production. And in this article, he pointed out the failure of our legal system to offer even minimal protections to animals who are kept in intensive confinements, who are slaughtered. He pointed out that the majority of the state anti-cruelty laws exempted what are called common and standard farming practices, and that trying to change those laws through state legislatures would be a failure because at the state level, there are agriculture committees which are controlled by industry. And as soon as you tried to introduce a law to give greater protection to farmed animals, they would never get past those agriculture committees. And he was right. So he pointed that out, that law review article has been given widespread attention, and it still to this day is largely correct. But he didn't do just that. He went to work for a large law firm, and as part of his contract with them, he said, I want to do pro bono, which means for free work. And the for free work he was doing was for Farm Sanctuary. Hmm. So in his free hours, he was working for Farm Sanctuary and pushing the issue as much as he could. And in the late 1990s, he thought it was time to develop a coalition effort. He wanted the bigger groups to be brought into working on farmed animal issues. And so he held a meeting, and I was at that meeting, and the meeting was an utter failure. It was just awful. He brought in Peter Stevenson from Compassion in World Farming in England. He brought in Richard Ryder. And basically, their role was to say to those of us in the U.S., you folks are way behind, and you need to catch up. What are we going to do? But it was interesting, the people in the U.S. who were leaders in the movement weren't getting it. They just couldn't see how to work together. They couldn't agree on what issues we should work on. And it was just, it was a very depressing meeting. But Wolfson's a tenacious guy, and he said to himself, okay, to heck with those people. I'm talking to the wrong people. I need to talk to the person who has money and power. And that's Wayne Pacelli. Wayne Pacelli is the head of the Humane Society of the U.S. And so Wolfson cornered him and pressured him and kept beating him up until Wayne finally said, okay, I get what you're trying to say. And at that point, we formed a much smaller coalition with HSUS, Wayne Pacelli, Mike Markarian, the Fund for Animals, Farm Sanctuary, Gene Bauer, and David Wolfson, and Marianne Sullivan in New York, and Peter Stevenson from England, and Animal Legal Defense Fund. We came in, and we decided to introduce the first initiative. Now, what an initiative is it works outside of the state legislature.
Okay? And just to be clear, this is something that we don't have here in Canada.
Right.
Correct?
Yeah. And
which is unfortunate, but
right. It's something that you would really benefit from. We have it in some states in the United States, but not in others. And I don't think it exists in England, and I know it doesn't exist in Australia because I was there a year ago and people were their jaws dropped when I told them about it. So just briefly describe what an initiative is. It is a very short piece of legislation that is taken directly to the voting public. In order to get it on a ballot, it has to be brought to the public as part of a regular election. And in order to get it on the ballot, you have to get a certain number of signatures, something like 650,000 signatures in order to get it on the ballot. It's a difficult, expensive process, but if you can do it, it's wonderful. Mm. So the first project was an initiative in Florida, in the state of Florida, to ban sow gestation crates. And several factors led us to choose Florida. One is that it has a relatively small sow pig industry. So we were less likely to be fought by big industry.
Okay.
Second is that there was an individual who was willing to give some funding that was going to help, because these initiatives actually cost millions of dollars. And that's pretty scary. Third is that we did some polling, HSUS did polling, and it appeared that the voters would buy in, that the potential for success was high enough for us to take the risk. So we went out and gathered the signatures. We worked with a lot of people in Florida to gather the signatures we needed to get it on the ballot. In 2002, Florida voters passed this initiative to ban gestation crates by a vote of 55% to 45%. And that was what opened the door for similar campaigns in other states. HSUS then went to Arizona in 2006, and Arizona voters passed a ban on gestation crates and veal calf crates. And at that point, that's when Maple Leaf, the largest Canadian pork producer, announced that it was going to phase out the use of gestation crates. So isn't that interesting that even though there isn't an initiative process in Canada, Maple Leaf saw the writing on the wall and made that announcement. In 2007, Oregon's legislature said, ooh, before they come here with an initiative, we're going to ban gestation crates. And Maine and Colorado passed similar laws. Michigan legislature brought about a phase out of veal crates for calves and gestation crates for sows in 2009 and battery cages for laying hens. And then in 2010, HSUS went to Ohio, threatened an initiative, and the Ohio Farm Bureau and other agricultural groups agreed that they would phase out veal and gestation crates and ban the transport of downer cows. In 2008, HSUS Farm Sanctuary, and we worked with them, brought the most intensive fight to California. California is a big farming state, and this was where the pedal was going to meet the metal, because agribusiness industry, we knew, was going to come down on us like a ton of bricks, and they did. It was quite extraordinary what they did to try to stop this campaign. But California's Prevention of Farm Animal Cruelty Act was passed by the voters by 63.5%, making it a crime to confine hens in cages, calves in veal crates, and pigs in gestation crates. And so from the late 90s, where we had nothing, to 2009, there was really an extraordinary sea change in the U.S. With regard to farmed animals. And we're continuing this process, but it was all done through either legislation or initiatives. Litigation was used, especially in California, because the agriculture industry was pulling a lot of tricky things, and it was HSUS's in-house attorneys who led a highly organized and effective campaign to combat, to counteract what the industry was doing, so that the legislative effort, the initiative effort rather, could move forward. So that's why, in my mind, it all has to work together. Legislation, litigation, the education of the public, it all has to work together.
As you're recalling these successes, Florida with the sow gestation crates and in California and et cetera, I'm just reminded of criticisms that pop up that these changes don't offer genuine protection, and you know, it's sort of fuzzy around what actually counts as improved conditions. I mean, this is a major debate, and a lot of people frame it as, you know, the welfare versus abolition debate. And I'm just, you know, rather than asking you to weigh in on that debate, I'm just curious what role this debate has had in sort of shaping the direction of the Animal Legal Defense Fund. You know, how has it shaped the direction of the organization?
The abolition versus regulation debate has, it's been there as long as I've been in the movement, and far longer than that. A problem that we face as lawyers is that, as I said at the very beginning, we are in a legal system that protects the status quo. And the status quo is that animals are property and they can be used in any way that their owners would like to use them, with certain very limited restrictions. So to talk about abolition is very difficult. There's no law on the books that enables us to stop researchers from using animals. It simply doesn't exist. So there's nothing for us to go to court with. We can't claim that it violates the state anti-cruelty laws for a number of reasons that have to do with technical issues such as preemption by federal laws over state laws. Mm. And as I'm saying that, I'm thinking, oh, well, but there's this case and there's that case. The bottom line is, as lawyers, really mostly all we can do is regulation. It's like asking an actor to act out a play, but there's no script for it. Mm. There are no words to say. There are no laws that give us the ability to abolish any of the current uses of animals. And those laws would have to be drafted. And before those laws could be drafted, society needs to be educated and brought around the mass of society. You need at least 50% of the people who are going to say, yeah, that's a good law, I will support that. We need to, you know, build that support in our society. We're doing nothing short of trying to change society, and that's not an easy thing. It never was. I often tell students, when I'm speaking to law students, it is very humbling and frustrating, and it really eats away at me and many other people, that there are these horrendous abuses, that the lives of most animals are lives of pain and frustration and torture. And this is happening, and, you know, we're screaming on our insides, I want this to stop. I want this to go away. What can I do? And then when you realize how little you can do in some ways as a lawyer, a lot of people just think, well, then what use is the law? And the response is, if you don't try, you're never going to move that peanut that Henry Spear talked about. Henry Spear talked about pushing the peanut forward. You're never going to push that peanut forward unless you start somewhere. And I don't know if this will help or just frustrate people more, but I always think about, you know, in the United States, we have a history, a very dark, ugly history of slavery that started back in the early 1600s. The first Africans were kidnapped and brought to the United States and other areas around 1608, 1610, very long ago. The first abolitionists started to appear, and they tended to be church people, religious people, people who said, this is just morally, ethically impermissible. And that was in the early 1700s. So 100 years passed in which people's lives were devastated, and they were forced to do labor for free, and they were forced to be treated. They were property. So when the first abolitionists came into being and started speaking publicly around 1710 or so, think of how they must have felt. Africans who were brought to this country were property, and all of the laws that were in place protected that property status. And it wasn't until really the 1830s that abolition started to pick up steam. There was a war that had to be fought in order for that viewpoint to finally be put into law in 1865. And that wasn't the end of it. Then there were the Jim Crow laws that protected the rights to keep African Americans down and to, you know, make it so that they couldn't get jobs and couldn't get education. And it's 350 years from the early 1600s until today, when we still are dealing with the after effects of slavery. And African Americans in America are still in a society that I can tell you is very racist, and that holds them back. So if you look at that, if you look at how long it has taken for human beings to be brought out of slavery, to be given their freedom, and then to be given education and jobs and everything else that it has taken for them to be treated as equals, we've got a long road ahead of us with what we're dealing with animals. And that's a very sad statement to have to make, but we have to start. We have to do whatever we can, wherever we can, and we have to do what we can effectively within the current legal system that we have, so that we create a society that views animals differently and that is willing to treat them differently. And we are fighting against interests such as the meat industry, the fur industry, the research industry. These are massive industries that rely on the use of animals, that will fight hard to protect the use of animals and maintain the status quo. They will vote against us. They will work against us. They will do whatever they can to convince people that we're crazy and reckless and blah, 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 everything else that they call us. So we have an enormous task, and we have to be professional and smart and effective and do whatever we can to push that peanut forward and to work so that someday the world will be a better place for animals. And we want to make that someday as soon as possible.
Joyce, we're just about out of time here. And I just wanted to give you just a moment to remind people about the Animal Legal Defense Fund, how they can get involved, how they can contact or donate, just before we go.
Sure, thank you. The Animal Legal Defense Fund has a website. It's www.aldf.org. It's our acronym, www.aldf.org. And we have a variety of resources on our website about things you can do to help us do our work, things you can do to help animals in your own communities. And so please check our website. Take a look around. There are things that will help you if your neighbors are being unkind to animals, if a veterinarian malpractice, all of that is on there under resources. And we tell you about conferences. We tell you about all sorts of things. So please come visit our website.
Thank you, Joyce. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
We were just joined by Joyce Tischler from the Animal Legal Defense Fund. A big thank you to Steve Romanen for teching the show, Kevin Tillman for his contribution from the vegan hip-hop movement, Dan Agronon for producing the show, Aaron O'Sullivan, and Neil Harvey for turning this show into an MP3, making that available on podcast. You can access our archive of over 350 podcasts at our website, animalvoices.ca, and drop us a line at animalvoices@gmail.com for any show ideas, suggestions, comments, and we'll see you next week.